saved his life. His lips had no sooner touched the water than he heard men's voices. It was a native tongue, and they were loud and laughing. There were two of them. Had they come upon Samuel, they surely would have taken or killed him. Samuel kept his head near the ground. Through small holes in the brush, he could see them from the waist down. They wore leather leggings and high moccasins, and each carried a musket in one hand. He could see the butts hanging down at their sides, and either a coup-stick or a killing lance in the other. Both of the men had fresh scalps hanging on the shafts they carried. For the first time in his life, Samuel wanted to kill a man. The overwhelming rage that he had begun to feel while following his mother's small footprints, as she had been savagely jerked along the trail, was like a hot knife in his brain. If there had only been one, he would have done it. But he carried no tomahawk. All he had was a skinning knife, and his rifle fired only one shot. After that, the one he didn't shoot would turn on him before he could reload. With only a knife to defend himself, he'd have almost no chance. So he waited until they were out of sight. Then, staying low and moving slowly, he went back to the trail. Why had the men come back? Whatever the reason, two men alone would not backtrack too far into potentially hostile country. If there were any kind of force after them, they would want to keep moving. So Samuel thought, maybe I'm getting close. He picked up the pace to a jog, but stayed well to the side of the trail on the edge of the thicker undergrowth in case he ran into any others, and again, this move saved his life. Clearings left by old beaver ponds were scattered through the forest. Some were small, an acre or two, others were 30 or 40 acres. A large clearing popped up in front of Samuel now. It was late afternoon, almost evening, and the sun slanted from the west behind him into the clearing. It was another stroke of luck. The clearing had been turned into a large encampment, filled with Indians, some British soldiers in red uniforms, and nearly a quarter of a mile away, freight wagons hooked up to horses. Samuel slid into the underbrush. He crawled farther back where he couldn't be seen. Unfortunately, he couldn't see either, and he squatted in the thick foliage and tried to remember what he'd seen. Three wagons ready to go out, 10 or 15 soldiers, including 3 officers on horses, and 10 or 15 Indians. He shook his head. No. Not so many soldiers, 7 or 8, and fewer Indians, 8 or 9. One large fire in the center of the clearing, one smaller one closer to the wagons. A group of people huddled there. The captives. There hadn't been time to see them clearly, and they were too far away from him to see if his mother and father were in the group. In a rope pen near the wagons were 1 or 2 horses, 3 or 4 oxen, maybe a milk cow. There was also a spit set up over a larger fire with some kind of big animal cooking, which meant they were going to be here for some time, perhaps the night. He settled slowly back on his haunches, careful not to move the brush around him. He had caught up to them. There was a chance his mother and father were with that group of captives. He still had no plan to rescue them. Everything he'd done was just to catch up, see if they were still alive. Could they be here? He hadn't come across their bodies on the trail, and there were captives by the fire. For the moment, that was enough. The plan would come later. It would be dark soon. There was still no moon. Now he was astonished that it had only been 40 or so hours since he returned from the hunt. His whole life, everything in it and around it, was different now. Torn and gutted, and forever changed from all that it had been, and it would never be the same. It would be dark soon. And in the dark, he thought, with no moon, in the near pitch dark of starlight, there might be possibilities. He had no plan, but it would be dark soon. And just then, as he settled back to wait and think on some way to get to the captives without being discovered, the whole world blew up. Warfare. The British procedure when fighting was to march at the foe in a close line with two or three ranks of men. The front rank would fire at 50 or 60 yards, then drop back and reload while the second rank stepped forward and fired, dropping back and reloading while the back rank came forward and fired. This rolling volley had the effect of creating a kind of mass firepower. The weapons were very simple, but it was almost impossible to stand against the line when the men grew close, quit firing altogether, and charged screaming. It took a special kind of courage to stand ready when a line of howling men ran at you with bayonets aimed at your stomach. Many times, American soldiers turned and ran rather than face what the British Army called the Wall of British Steel. Chapter 8. The natives began whooping and dancing around the large campfire, firing their muskets in the air in celebration. Samuel crept out slowly until he could partially see what was going on. He started to move back under cover when there was a sudden increase in the racket, and the sound was different. The Indians had been firing in the air as they danced, which caused the explosions to go up and away. They were firing smooth-bore muskets, weapons that made a muffled barking sound. But this new sound had the sharper, cracking quality of higher-velocity rifles. Samuel crept back out to the edge and saw that the shots had come from the north side of the clearing where another trail came in. 6 or 8 shots. Great clouds of black powder smoke came rolling out of the forest. A pause to reload, then 8 more shots. The Indians and British soldiers were stunned. A few Indians and one soldier went down, probably dead. Several others were wounded and hobbled into the brush for cover. But the Indians and British recovered and returned fire. Samuel was jarred by 2 important facts. First, whoever was attacking, this might end in the rescue of his parents. Second, he should help them. He moved to the clearing near the trail, raised his rifle, cocked it, and without thinking of the enormity of what he was doing, aimed at the nearest British soldier. He was less than 50 yards away. The German silver of Samuel's front sight settled on the red uniform. He set the first trigger and was moving his finger to the hair trigger when he heard a noise behind him. He wheeled, his rifle coming around him in time for him to see the 2 Indians who had nearly caught him earlier running straight at him. "What?" Half a word. Then one Indian, the one farther away, leveled his musket and fired. Samuel felt the ball graze his cheek. Without thinking, his rifle at his hip, he touched the hair trigger and in slow motion felt the rifle buck, saw the small hole appear in the Indian's chest. Then, through a cloud of smoke from his weapon, he watched the Indian fall as he saw the other Indian swing a tomahawk in a wide arc. He knew he couldn't raise his rifle in time to block the blow. The tomahawk was coming at his head, and he tried to duck. But the white-hot pain exploded as the side of the tomahawk smashed into his forehead. And then, nothing. Wounds. Untreated battle injuries often led to gangrene, which causes the body to literally rot away, turning first green, then black, from infection that travels rapidly. Because antibiotics were unavailable in the 18th century, amputation was the usual treatment. Due to the horrific odor of gangrene, surgeons could smell the patient and make an accurate diagnosis. If the patient was not lucky enough to benefit from amputation, maggots would be introduced into the wound in an attempt to aid healing. They would eat away the infection. Barring the surgical removal of body parts or the use of parasites, doing absolutely nothing and letting the patient die was the only option at the time. Chapter 9. Strange dreams. Visions of unreality. Endless screams that started with low grunts and became more and more shrill until they cut his soul. Dreams of his mother dressed all in buckskins, ladling some kind of thick stew with a wooden spoon into a wooden bowl, chewing tobacco, and spitting off to the side while she held the bowl out, shaking her head. "He ain't anywhere near right yet." She spit her wad of tobacco juice out again, brain scrambled to hell and gone. Then a trap door came down, a lid, something thick and dark, and there was no light at all. Just blessed darkness and sleep, 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 and more screams. No sense of time. Once he tried to remember his name and fought with it for a minute, or a day, or a week, or 10 years, he couldn't tell. More dreams, scattered. His mother, this time wrapped in a blanket with stringy black hair hanging down at the sides of her head while she chewed an obnoxious cud. She disgorged it, slapped it on his head, and tied it on with a filthy rag, spitting more tobacco juice out and nodding. "Gotta get the pison out or she's going to rot on him." It was as if his eyes never really opened, as if he saw everything through closed lids, and the images that swirled through his mind were so mixed that they became a blur. Night, day, light and darkness seemed to flop and flow over each other. Pictures would stick for a moment and then go. A horse, then a cow, then his mother leaning down, still in the dirty blanket, greasy black hair hanging down the sides of her head, raising the poultice and grinning, spitting more tobacco juice. "Coming clean now," she said. "Clear pus. Looks clean as spring water. All the yeller gone." And then bouncing, incredibly rough bouncing, as if someone were jumping on a bed while he was trying to sleep. He would pass out in pain, rolling waves of pain. Finally, a picture stopped, just stopped in front of his eyes, in front of his mind, locked in. It was dark or night, and he was on some kind of wooden frame lying on the ground. A fire burned nearby, and when he opened his eyes wide, the light from the fire seemed to shove a lance into the middle of his head. He grunted in pain. He closed his eyes and waited for the rolling pictures to begin again. When they didn't, he opened his eyes, but only in a slit. The image was the same, a bed frame of some kind, a fire, and this time less pain from the light. As he watched, an arm came out of nowhere and put a piece of wood on the fire, then withdrew. He tried to move his head and see where the arm went, but the pain was so intense he nearly lost consciousness. He lay back and closed his eyes, opened them again when the pain receded. "Where? Who?" The words pealed in his mind like a bell, echoing around inside his head. A figure appeared next to the fire. Not his mother, but a young man with stringy black hair and a cheek full of tobacco juice. He leaned down, his face close to Samuel's. "You in there, righteous, or are you going away again?"
I'm here."
"Who are you?"
"John. John Cooper. Most just call me Coop."
"Where?"
"Long story, that. We be about 12 miles from where you got that egg on your head. 12 miles in distance, more than that in time."
"When?" "I don't remember. Some Indians. I think I shot at one, and then nothing."
"Why did I shoot at an Indian?"
"Can't tell. We come on these Iroquois and some redcoats. We'd already seen what they took and done back at Miller's Crossing, so we snuck up proper and took them on."
"I remember. You were shooting. You say we. Where are the others?"
"Asleep. I'm the night watch tonight. Bless, I've been doctoring you, and I thought you might lose your light during the night. You've been breathing like an old pump. I guess you was just sucking air hard because you didn't die. Of course, it could still happen. I had a cousin got kicked in the head by a mule. They's fractious, mules. And he lived for nigh on 2 months 'fore he lost his light.
He never talked none except now and again a kind of moan, like somebody stepping on a duck. Then he just up and died.
Samuel closed his eyes, felt his spinning. Then, as if a fog were lifted, it all came back. I was tracking Ma and Pa. The redcoats, the Indians, hid our place while I was looking for Bear. They killed most everybody but took my parents and a few others captive.
Coop nodded. We saw them, all around a fire. Ropes tying them together.
What happened to them?
Coop shrugged. Wasn't much of a fight. We fired once, reloaded, laid out another round, and they ran. Them redcoats had wagons already hooked up, and they piled the captives into wagons and lit out. We couldn't shoot no more for fear of hitting the captives. The Indians just drifted away like smoke. That would have been that, except one of them put a musket ball in Paul. It was in his gut, awful place, that. We knew he was going to die, ain't nobody comes back from a belly wound, and kept waiting for it, but he made 4 days. He gave up his light last night. No, night before. Died screaming. It was bad. Surprised it didn't bring you out of your stupor, the screaming. Kept everybody up all night.
Samuel closed his eyes again, trying to put numbers together. Died 1 2 days ago, after making 4 days. If a belly wound took 4 days to kill, and it happened the day of the fight, but Paul died 2 days ago. How long since they took the captives, since the fight?
5 6 days? You've been out 6 days. We like to not found you, and when we did, we almost left you. Thought you was with the raiders.
Me? Why?
Well, you wasn't with us, so we thought you was with them. But Carl did some thinking on it. Carl's my brother, and he's the one to think on things. And said, look how messed up your head was, where they clubbed you, and look at the bullet hole in the Indian you killed. That's a honey of a little rifle you got. And how could you be with them and still get clubbed and shoot one of them? So we took you with us.
I've been out 6 days?
Closer to 7, counting the night.
And did you say we'd come 12 miles?
Coop nodded. First 3 days. No, 4. We let you delay. Everybody thought you would die, and there wasn't no sense dragging you. Then there was Paul with his belly wound. If we tried to move him, he would scream like a panther. Then we rigged up a drag and started to pull you back of one of them oxen they left behind when they ran.
All the bumping.
Coop nodded, spit tobacco juice in the fire and listened to it hiss. We couldn't stay too long and thought you could die just as well dragging as you could laying up somewhere. If we'd left you, something would have come along and ate you. So here you are.
My head. Coop nodded.
Good cut from that hawk. Carl took some deer sinew he had and an old needle he carries for fixing and sewed it up right pert. He said in case you lived wouldn't be much of a scar across your forehead.
Coop smiled and with some pride added,
it came on to having green pus and everybody knows that's bad. So I made up a spit and backy poultice and tied it on with a piece of rag. Pus cleared up in 2 days.
So I've been laying for 6 days?
Another nod. Coming on 7.
Well, how?
With a start, Samuel realized he didn't have any pants on underneath the coarse blanket that covered him.
How come I'm not all messed up?
We took your pants off. Got 'em wrapped in a blanket pack with your rifle. Indian must have been in a hurry, or he would have took it. Sweet little shooter like that. Also got your possibles bag and powder horn. What you feel under your rear is fresh grass. Any time you messed, we just threw the old grass away and pulled in a half a foot of fresh new grass. Slick as a new calf. Or maybe slick as a baby's bottom.
Maybe I should put my leggings on.
Only if you ain't going out of your head again.
I don't think so.
Suits me. I was the one having to get new grass all the time. You ain't et nothing other than a little broth I got down you one time, some water now and again. Man can go a long time without food, no time at all without he has some water. I'm starving, Samuel said automatically. But with the words came the feeling, and he realized he was as hungry as he'd ever been. You ought to drink something soft first. Coop handed him a wooden bowl with a mixture of broth and meat. Go slow. This is from some salted ox they was cooking when we jumped them. Samuel took the bowl. He tried to drink slowly, but as the taste and smell hit him, he couldn't help gulping at it, meat and all, so fast that he gagged and threw up. Slow, Coop repeated, coming back with a blanket roll and putting it on the ground next to Samuel. You'll founder. You don't go slow. Samuel started over carefully. There was silence as he ate, chewing completely before swallowing small bites, small swallows. It's like fire, he thought, when you're cold. Fire moving through your body. He ate the first bowl, handed it to Coop, and watched him refill it, this time with broth and chunks of glistening fat as well as meat. This second bowl he drank and ate more slowly than the first. And while he ate, he made a mental list of questions to ask when his stomach was full. Why are you here? How many of you are there? Where are you going? Is there any way you can help me find my mother and father? Are you... Will you... Can you... Do you... Questions roaring through his mind. He finished eating. He lay back. He opened his mouth to ask the first question, and his eyes closed at the same instant, and he was immediately asleep. And the last thing he thought as he went under was that he still hadn't put his pants on. American Spirit. Although poorly trained and weakly led and improperly fed, so badly that soldiers sometimes had to eat their shoes, the Americans took comfort from fighting on home soil and usually had much higher morale than the British. While they were often outnumbered and fought with inferior equipment, this spirit had an enormous effect, and they took the phrase, morale is to fighting as four is to one, to heart on the battlefields. Chapter 10. This time the sounds of men coughing and axes chopping wood for the fire awakened Samuel. He opened his eyes. The pain was much less. And he saw that it was daybreak. Men were moving all around him. He started to roll, but the head pain stopped him, as well as the sudden memory that he had no pants on. The bedroll was next to him where Coop had put it. He snaked his pants out, pulled them on, and fastened them with the leather cord around the waist. The pain in his head had abated. It only jabbed if he moved suddenly. The wound felt tight, as if someone were pulling the top of his scalp together. When he unrolled the blanket, his rifle half fell out, and he saw that the lock had dirt jammed around the flint and pan, pushing up the striker plate or frizzen, so the rifle was not able to fire. The men were making fire, tying bedrolls. One man had what looked to be a permanently bent left arm held up at a slight angle. He was sitting on the ground cleaning his rifle. It made Samuel feel embarrassed that his own lock was so dirty. He found his possibles bag in the blanket roll. This was a pouch with the powder horn attached that hung around his neck, where he carried odds and ends of equipment for cleaning and firing his rifle. Inside he had a tiny piece of steel wire. After blowing the dirt out of the pan and frizzen and flint, he used the wire to clear the touch hole, which fed the jet of flame from the pan into the powder charge. Then he used an oily rag to clean the whole area, and put some finely ground black powder into the pan. This was the ignition powder that the flint metal sparks would fire into the powder charge. He closed the frizzen over the pan, eased the hammer to half-cock, safety, and set the rifle aside. The fire had flared up as the men added wood. Samuel rose to his feet and went into the nearby bushes to relieve himself. His legs were wobbly, but seemed to work well enough, even though he felt weak as a kitten. As one part of his body got better, another would follow. As the pain in his head went down, the hunger in his belly came up. There was the entire back leg from an ox over the fire on a metal spit. Last night, Coop had been cutting bits of it to put in Samuel's broth. Looking at it made Samuel even more ravenous. But the other men weren't eating, so he held back. One, a thin man with a scraggly beard, saw Samuel looking at the meat. He pulled a knife, really a short sword, carved off a generous piece and handed it to Samuel. "You got to eat. We might walk long today, and it's going to be hard for you to keep up without your belly full." "Thank you." Samuel took the meat. It was very tough, and he sat chewing and swallowing, watching the men clear up camp. While Samuel watched the men and ate, he also rolled and tied up his bedroll, making certain his powder was dry and his possibles bag was ready to go. But these men were even faster. Without speaking, except to grunt and point, they seemed to get everything done with the least effort and in the quickest time. The ox was yoked and tied off to a tree. The skid that Samuel had been on, which had two long tongues that went up either side of the ox and attached to the yoke, was hooked up and packed with extra equipment, the cooking pot, blankets, muskets, a small keg of powder, and another of whiskey, and of all things, a drum left by the fleeing redcoats and Indians. Then the men came and stood by the fire. In silence, they cut pieces of meat and ate, drinking creek water out of a wooden bucket with a wooden dipper. Samuel still had dozens of questions, but since the men were silent as they stood staring into the fire while they chewed, he held his tongue. There were seven men. When everybody was done eating, they each took a plug of tobacco and poked it in their cheek or lower jaw. They put the leftover meat on the skid, wrapped in a piece of green oxhide to keep the flies off, then used the bucket to fetch water from the creek to put the fire out. With no effort at all, they were moving along the trail. Two men went well ahead, one left, one right of the trail. The rest formed a column, if five men could be called a column, just ahead of the ox and Samuel. In Samuel's weakened condition, there was absolutely no way he could have kept up with the men. But the ox saved him. He knew that oxen tend to plod a little less than 2 miles an hour, and this ox was slower yet. Even Samuel had no trouble keeping up with him, and when his legs felt a little weak, he would move to the ox's side and hold on to the yoke, letting the ox pull him along for a time. Every hour and a half, the two men walking ahead would come in, and two others would move out. On one of those cycles, Coop came back and walked near Samuel. It was what Samuel had been waiting for. "You kept me alive. Thank you." "It weren't much. A little tobacco and spit and tough meat." "I'd have been done if you hadn't come along." "Maybe, maybe not. One never knows how a wind is going to blow." "Why did you all come along? Where are you going?" Coop spit. The men all spit. Almost all the time. Samuel had once tried tobacco, first in a clay pipe, then taking a chew, and it had made him sick as a dog. He couldn't see the sense in using it, but all these men seemed to chew all the time and spit like fountains. "Maybe something happened to your taster when you got older," he thought, "so you didn't mind it." "We're going to jine up," Coop said, pointing east with his chin, "and fight them redcoats. There be a feller named Morgan, round about Boston City, starting up Morgan's Rifles. We all shoot rifles, and we figure to give them redcoats a taste of good shootin'. They got nothing but muskets, good for nothing after 50, 60 yards. Carl here," he pointed up to where his brother walked beside the head of the ox, "he can pink a man on a horse out to 200, 300 yards every time. Wouldn't even know what hit him, nor where it came from. He nodded his chin at the group. Every man here can hit a foot-square piece of paper every time at 200 yards. I suppose you could, too, took a mind to it. I'm not sure about killing. You did that Indian back there, laying dead and had a bullet hole in him. I wasn't aiming. He shot, and I pulled the trigger. What you gonna do when you find your mam and pap? Shake hands with them that took them? Samuel felt like spitting, too. I haven't thought that far yet. Best be thinking on it, and keep your powder dry and your pan primed. Right. Thing is, I didn't even know there was anybody to fight. Who was good or bad, which side to be on. Coop snorted. Don't take much thinking. Them that starts into killing people for no reason, them that comes and takes your folks with a rope around their necks, they's the bad ones. Your good people don't do that. What reason? Samuel stumbled on a rock. To his surprise, the ox was aware of it and hesitated to let him catch up. Why did those British redcoats and Indians attack us like that? There was no reason. We weren't against the crown or rebels or anything. Coop spit, neatly taking a fly off the ox's ear. He snorted. Redcoats doing it because they's redcoats, and ain't worth a tinker's dam. Follerin' orders. Indians doing it because they was hired to do it. They's Iroquois. Most of them work for the English, always have, always will. Ever since that French war. They've got all the plunder they can carry and scalp money from the redcoats. Heard there's a man named Hamlin, some kind of redcoat officer. Buy so many scalps they call him Herr Buyer Hamlin. What I don't understand is why they took your folks instead of killing... Oh, look, the front line is coming in. The column stopped by a clear water creek, and everybody drank. Then the men took the meat off the drag and sat in a circle cutting pieces and chewing. At first, Samuel hung back, but Carl motioned him to squat and eat. Samuel was feeling stronger by the minute, and the meat heated him like fire. No one talked much except for Coop, and when they finished, they rose, took a chew of tobacco, and set off. Coop and another man went ahead. Samuel walked in silence, hanging on to the wooden shaft tied to the ox. It was mid-morning, and the sun fell through tall trees on either side of the trail, so they seemed to be walking in a lighted green tunnel. Now and then insects caught sunlight and flashed white like small lamps. Any other time, Samuel would have been taken by the beauty of it. But now he could not stop thinking of what Coop had started to say. Why hadn't the raiders killed his parents? And would they do it now? I'm way behind them, he thought, 6, maybe 7 days, dragging along with an ox. God only knows what's happening to them. I have to go faster. The Hessians. The British also used mercenary soldiers, issued with the same Brown Bess musket and bayonet. Most of them were troops from Germany, called Hessians. While they were relatively effective as combat soldiers, they brought with them such savage, atrocious behavior and committed war crimes so far outside civilized behavior, bayoneting unarmed captive soldiers who had surrendered, farmers, women, including pregnant women, children, and even infants, that they became known as little more than beasts and were treated in kind. Chapter 11. He lay under overhanging hazel brush and studied the farm. Here, very close to the middle of the wild, was an almost perfect little farm. It had been 3 days since Samuel left the men behind. He'd eaten more and more meat, became stronger and stronger, and at last couldn't stand the slowness of walking beside the ox. The men were in no particular hurry, or as Coop said, still gonna be a war, catch it now or catch it later. And they had gear to move, so had to go slowly. But Samuel became more frantic with every step. At last, when they stopped to rest, he had told Coop he was going to take off on his own. Coop had nodded. "There will be people wanting to kill you," he said. "Well, let me cut those stitches out of your head. Healed up good." He set to work as he spoke. "Almost everybody you meet will want to kill you, so keep to the brush, keep your head down, and don't walk where others walk." He took out the last stitch. There was nothing more to say, so with a nod, Samuel turned away and trotted ahead of Coop and the rest of the men. Samuel took the advice to heart and worked well off the trail, which was becoming more like a road with two tracks. Even so, he doubled his speed. He had brought meat with him and took care to eat sparingly. After 3 days, it was nearly gone. He'd have to get more soon. Deer were as thick as fleas, and it was just a matter of shooting one. He was moving quietly through the woods, ready to do just that, when he came upon the farm. It had not been attacked and burned. It was a shock to see buildings standing and unharmed. And aside from that, this was a proper farm, not a frontier cabin hacked out of the woods. True, there was deep forest all around it, but the farm itself was neat as a pin, with split-rail fences all whitewashed, and a frame house, and a barn made not from logs, but from milled lumber. More, the house was painted white, and the barn red, with white trim on the doors and windows. As he watched, he could see chickens in the yard. Several thoughts hit him. First, chicken would taste good. The thought of a roasted chicken made him salivate. Second, if they hadn't been attacked, it must mean they were friendly to the raiders, who must have come right through here. Third, an easy jump in thinking. It would be all right for Samuel to confiscate a chicken, assuming the farmer was friendly with Samuel's mortal enemy. Now how to bring it about? He could wait until dark, but that was still at least 8 hours away. He couldn't waste time sitting here. The farm was in the middle of a large clearing. The tree line came close to the barn, and if he worked his way through the trees, he might get close enough to grab a chicken and run. He was moving before he stopped thinking of it. Since he saw no people as he moved around to the clearing in the back of the barn, he moved fast. He kept the barn between him and the house to block their view. In moments, he stood against the barn wall not 10 feet from a small flock of chickens pecking at the ground. Just as he started to make his move, he heard a scraping sound overhead and a barn loft door open. A little girl, 8 or 9, was looking down at him. "I saw you through a crack in the wall the whole way. You thought you were sneaking, but I saw you. You looked like a big, two-legged deer. What's wrong with your head? How come you're running like that? What are you after? Oh, the chickens. You want a chicken? Go ahead. I don't like them anyway." Samuel was so stunned that he couldn't say anything. Then he croaked in a whisper. "Is there anybody else here?" "They's all up at the house eating. They's eating squash and it makes me puke. So I came to the loft to play with my dolls. Go ahead. I won't tell." "Thank you. Take that big red one. She's mean. Chases me all over the yard, pecks at my toes." In for a penny, in for a pound, Samuel thought. He made a darting motion and by luck actually caught the big red chicken. It squawked once, but he held it tight and it quieted. He started to leave, then turned. "What's your name?" "Anne Marie Pennysworth Clark," she said. "But everybody calls me Annie." "Well, thank you, Annie. I've got to be going now." He turned to leave, but her next words stopped him. "You look just like the man who was here, except he was older and his head wasn't all cut up." "What man?" "Some men and a woman came here, some on horses and some in a wagon." At that instant, an enormous man holding a rifle came around the end of the barn. He had shoulders like a bear, and his gun was pointed at Samuel's face. Samuel dropped the chicken, raised his own rifle, and aimed it at the center of the man. After a second, Samuel lowered his weapon. As soon as it moved, the man dropped his. Samuel had forgotten to breathe. He took a deep breath now. "My name is Samuel," he said. "I thought a fox was in the chickens when I heard the hen squawk," the man shrugged. "Wasn't too far off." "I don't steal," Samuel's face burned. "But I've been on some rough trail, and I got hungry."
"He wasn't stealing, Pa," Annie piped up. "I told him to take that red one. She keeps trying to eat my toes."
"I never turned anybody away from my door hungry," the man said. He held out his hand. "Caleb Clark, come up to the house and eat."
It all seemed so natural and open that Samuel forgot his earlier suspicion that the farmer was on the enemy's side. He took the man's hand.
"Thank you, sir." "Let's stop by the pump and wash your head first. It's a sight. Ma will have a fit."
"I got hit by an Indian, and these men came along and sewed me up."
"It looks," Caleb said, smiling, "like you got hit by a club and then some men stitched it up and smeared some kind of dark mud or something on it."
"Tobacco juice," Samuel said, "and spit. They made a poultice, and it saved me."
They were at the watering trough and pump. Caleb took Samuel's rifle. Samuel handed it over without thinking. Caleb held Samuel's head under the pump and started working the handle.
"Scrub," he said, pumping harder. Samuel winced at the pain, but went to work carefully. Finally, the wound was clean enough to suit Caleb, and they went to the house. Annie followed, and sure enough, the red hen pecked at her toes. Annie yelped and scurried ahead of Samuel and Caleb to the house. Samuel had never been in anything but a cabin, most often with a dirt floor, or at best a crude plank one. And Caleb's house seemed too fine, as if Samuel somehow shouldn't be allowed in, at least not without being boiled clean first. The house inside was as neat as the outside, with plastered white walls and a sugar pine board floor, polished and rubbed with beeswax.
"Company, Ma," Caleb said. "You got another plate?"
Caleb's wife was quite round, with red cheeks and hair up in a bun. She had flour dust on her cheek. She pushed a bit of hair back and smiled at Samuel with the briefest of looks. She pointed at a chair that backed to the stove. "Sit and eat. We just started." They were only three people, four with Samuel. But the table absolutely groaned with food. There was squash, as Annie had said, with maple sugar and butter melted in the middle. There was a roast of venison and potatoes, a loaf of bread with apple butter and some kind of jelly, and corn on the cob with melted butter dripping from the cobs. Samuel had never seen anything like it. Huge bowls of food, and a gravy tub that held at least a quart of rich, brown, steaming hot gravy. His stomach growled as Caleb poured him some buttermilk, and they all sat. There were a fork and spoon and knife at each place. Samuel waited to see how things were done. Caleb smiled.
"We'll say grace."
They held hands, which seemed strange. Annie was to his left. She decided that since he was there, she'd sit to eat, and she grabbed his hand. Caleb's big paw took his other hand, and in a deep voice he rumbled,
"Thank you, Lord, for this food and this company. In Jesus' name, amen."
And they set to. Nobody spoke. Ma heaped his plate with food. It seemed more than he could possibly eat. He was sure his stomach had shrunk, but he somehow got it all tucked in, and he felt full as a tick. Then Ma brought out rhubarb pie with thick cream sprinkled with maple sugar, and somehow he got that down as well.
"Thank you, ma'am," he said. "I've never eaten like that, not in my whole life. Even at fall feast, it wasn't that good or that much. I won't have to eat for a week.
I just wish my folks...
He stopped, remembering what Annie had said. He turned to her.
You said some men came, and one of them looked like me.
Caleb cut in. Some British soldiers came here with two wagons holding fugitives or captives. Five of them. I fed the soldiers, and they were civil enough and didn't bother us, though I heard some bad stories of the Hessians that hit some farms east of here. Then I took food and water out to the captives, and one man, had his wife with him, was very polite and thanked me. He looked like you, same eyes and nose.
He was my father, and that was my mother.
Samuel looked down at the floor and blinked away the burning in his eyes. Annie softly patted his shoulder. He told the story of the attack, leaving out the worst details because of Annie. When he was finished, Ma was crying, and he was having trouble holding tears back himself.
When were they here? He asked. How long ago?
3 days. After they ate, they watered the horses, and while they were waiting for the horses to blow and settle the water, the lead officer pulled out a little traveling chessboard. I don't know how to play, but he went to the captives, and your pa sat and played a game with him on the edge of the wagon.
He loves chess.
I heard the officer say to another soldier that the only reason he brought your father was that he saw a chessboard when they raided the cabin, and he wanted somebody to play with.
Thank God, Samuel thought. Thank God for such a little thing to mean so much.
His father's life spared for a chessboard. His mother's life, too.
He stood. Thank you for the food. I have to be going. If I'm only 3 days behind and they keep taking it slow, I could catch them.
Caleb said.
They're headed for New York, the city. The British hold it, and they keep a lot of prisoners there in old warehouses and out in the harbor on old ships. If you don't catch them along the trail, you might just go there. Good luck to you, son. We'll keep you in our prayers.
Ma pressed more food on him, venison, potatoes, and corn, wrapped in a piece of linen. Annie and Ma hugged him, and Caleb shook his hand. Then he trotted slowly, his stomach still heavy, out of the yard to the edge of the woods, where he entered thick forest. He stayed well off to the side of the trail. Once again, this small act saved his life. He heard one clink, metal on metal, and dropped to his stomach out of sight, though he could see through gaps in the brush. He watched them pass, an organized body of troops with tall hats moving at a quick step in a tight formation. They followed an officer on a large bay horse. They did not look like British soldiers. They had brownish instead of red uniforms and were more disciplined than the redcoats.
Hessians, he thought. Germans.
They were quickly past Samuel. Their march would take them directly to Caleb's farm. Curious and with some fear, Samuel turned and followed them, off to the side, 50 yards to the rear. He'd relive that decision for many sleepless nights. The attack was over in minutes. The Hessians quick marched into the yard, broke formation and spread out into the farmyard, grabbing chickens as they moved. Caleb and Ma came out onto the porch. Caleb wasn't armed, though he raised his arm and pointed at the soldiers. He and Ma were immediately gunned down. Then four soldiers jumped to the porch and bayoneted them. Annie exploded out of the house and ran toward the barn. Three or four of the soldiers shot at her but missed, and once she was around the barn, she ran for the trees. More men tried to hit her but missed. Samuel was amazed at how fast she ran. She stumbled once, and it looked as if she might be hit, but she jumped to her feet and kept running. They took the bodies of Caleb and Ma and dragged them back into the house. 8 or 10 men went into the house then and looted it, taking anything shiny and all the food they could find. Then they set fire to the house and barn. And when those were roaring with flames, the soldiers fell into formation and quick marched out of the yard, disappearing down the trail.
It had taken less than 10 minutes. Samuel was sickened by the cruelty, the absolute viciousness of the attack, and he hunched over and retched. He felt that he should have run to Caleb and his wife to help in some way, but he knew there was nothing he could have done. He would have been dead long before he'd got at them. He was helpless. He sat crying, watching the house and barn burn, the Hessians gone like a plague. Caleb and Ma. The food, eating together. How open and gentle and pleasant and good it had been to sit with them and talk. Destroyed. Gone. Gone in this ugly war with these evil men. Gone and never coming back, and there was nothing, nothing he could do or could have done to save them, help them. Except find Annie. Take her with him to New York. He made certain nobody was coming down the trail, then set off at a trot around the clearing, staying well in the undergrowth, looking for Annie and trying to erase from his mind what he had seen. He had to find Annie. Then find his parents. That was all that mattered. Part 3. Green. New York, 1776. War Orphans. Children orphaned by war, as countless were during the Revolutionary War, suffer from nightmares and sleeping problems, headaches, stomach aches, anger, irritability, and anxiety. Severely traumatized children may become withdrawn, appearing numb and unresponsive, and sometimes becoming mute. When the danger and devastation end, children can show remarkable resilience and recovery if they are in a safe and stable environment where they are cared for and nurtured. After the Revolutionary War, however, many orphans, if they were not taken in by other family members, grew up in institutions. Formal adoptions were very rare. Chapter 12. He found Annie huddled in some hazel bushes, crying. When she saw him, she ran and threw herself at him, grabbing the edge of his shirt, silent except for the soft sobbing. For 3 days. Unless she was asleep or tending to herself, she would not get more than 4 feet away from him for 3 solid days. She held on to his clothing and did not say a word in all that time. At night, he would wrap her in his blanket and sit away from the glow of the fire and doze, and she would cry in her sleep almost all night. It bothered him that she had no shoes or moccasins, and he had no leather to make a pair for her. But her bare feet were amazingly tough, and she kept up with his rapid pace much better than he would have expected. They drank from creeks, which were common, and shared the small amount of food Ma had given him. Annie did not eat for the first 3 days, and he worried at that, although she drank. But in the evening of the 3rd day, she took some food and seemed to come out of the cloud she was in, little by little. He was having a very difficult time, with almost everything. The jolt from what his life had been just short weeks ago to what it was now had been so sudden, the gulf so vast, that he felt he was in a completely different world, one dominated by violence and insanity. The woods were the one thing he knew, and still believed in. He was thankful for the haven of the forest as they traveled. Still, his rage would not go away. He stifled it, but he seethed with anger every time he thought of the Hessians and how they had killed the Clarks, of how they had tried to kill Annie, of how the raiders had slaughtered the peaceful settlers for no reason. He wanted to punish them, make them pay for what they'd done, and could think of nothing to do except act as insane and violent as they had, kill someone. Find someone in a red coat and shoot him. He knew it was not something he could do, even though he thought of it. And so he drove himself and, unfortunately, Annie, in a forced march that covered over 15 miles a day. It would not have been so hard except that the trail had become a proper road. There was still forest on either side, but settlements, then small towns, appeared regularly, They often saw local people or detachments of redcoats marching on the road. They avoided everybody. Samuel trusted no one, not even people who might have been friendly. Annie complained only once. "We jump into the woods every time we see somebody," she said. "They can't all be bad." "Yes," Samuel said, thinking of the Hessians. "They can. Every single one of them can be bad, so we hide. And that's it." His voice had an edge that kept her from arguing. They worked around settlements and small towns, sticking to the trees. And on day 5, they'd been out of food for a day and a half, Samuel shot a deer and took an afternoon, well back in the woods, to make a small fire with flint and steel and a little powder. He cooked the 2 back legs of the deer with steaks holding them over the fire, and when the meat was still rare, cut pieces from one of the legs, and they ate it squatting by the fire. He also cut off the strips of meat alongside the lower backbone, the tenderloin. Although it was quite small, he cooked that as well to save for later. They ate a whole back leg sitting there until Annie's face was coated with grease. They wrapped the excess in the cloth Ma had given him and were up and moving again, Samuel not wanting to waste daylight. He could think of little but finding his parents and getting them away from their captors. But he also realized that the odds were not good. He knew nothing of cities or even towns. But New York City must be large and filled with people who would not be helpful since the British were there. Try as he might, he couldn't think of a way to get into the city safely to find his mother and father. With meat in his belly, he fairly loped along, so fast that at last Annie gasped, "You got to slow down. I can't run like a deer." He slowed, but kept the pace steady, so that when it was dark, hard dark, and he stopped, Annie fell asleep almost the instant he wrapped the bedroll blanket around her. He decided to make a cold camp and didn't start a fire. Since there was no smoke, the bugs, mostly mosquitoes, found him at once. They weren't as bad as they'd been on his hunting trips on the frontier, but then he'd always had a fire with the smoke to keep them away. He was tired, although not like Annie, and he had some thinking to do. It took him a while to get his mind off the mosquitoes, and by that time there was a new sliver of a moon. In the pale silver light he saw Annie's face, wrapped in the blanket, just showing enough to let her breathe, and his heart went out to her. She was only 8, he thought, maybe 9, and her whole world had been absolutely destroyed. Were there many like her? Everything gone because of this war? The innocent ones were the worst part of it all. His mother and father making a life on the frontier, just wanting to be left alone. His mother trying to get the garden to grow, his father learning how to use tools, how to make his own house, wanting only to work and read and think and live a quiet, simple life with his family. All gone. His own life gutted, not as much as Annie's, but enough. He had to get his parents back. How? What to do? There were so many unknown factors that the question seemed impossible. He was one person with a rifle. Oh, yes, he thought, smiling grimly. And a knife. And he felt that the entire world he was heading into was against him. He would have to get around them, the people in that world, some way, somehow. How? His eyes closed, opened, closed again. His questions spiraling down as he leaned back against a tree and slept. Civilian deaths. Civilian mortalities have always been underreported in wars and are nearly impossible to verify. Most historians and governments are forced to guess at the numbers because not only are birth and death certificates, church records, tax rolls, and immigration documentation frequently destroyed during combat, but the true numbers are, in many cases, never counted, in order to hide them from a country's own people as well as the enemy. Once mass weapons such as cannons and guns were developed and used by the military, far more civilians were killed simply by being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Chapter 13. The signs were on the side of a tree, two boards hacked into the shape of an arrow and nailed up with large, handmade cut nails.